Until recently, video games were, you know, games, not instructional tools, not team-building exercises, and certainly not propaganda machines. But nothing that engages young people stays pure forever. Eventually, it will be co-opted by those eager to have the attention of the next generation. Video gaming, therefore, was a natural target for such diverse institutions as the U.S. Army and the Chinese Communist Youth League. The phenomenon has captured the interest of writer Clive Thompson, who joins us once again. Clive, welcome back to OTM.
Good to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit of the history of so-called persuasive gaming?
Yeah, sure. For a long time, games were big, expensive things to make. I mean, millions of dollars would go into the average game that you'd go to a store and buy. But that started to change maybe 3 or 4 years ago because of the advent of online flash animation games, which almost anyone who knows a little bit of programming can make at home and put online for free for anyone to play. But the thing that got really interesting was that activists and artists and whatnot, they'd make little games that sort of had a political point, sort of an animated or game-like version of a political cartoon.
But then larger institutions got involved, not just ad hoc political commentators, but big organizations like, for example, the United States Army.
Yeah, that's right. They decided that what they need to do is get hip a little bit with what the gamers were doing, and they realized that if they produced a really good quality game that reflected as close as possible actual U.S. protocol and doctrine of war and put it out online for free for anyone to download and play. And this is a fantastic game. I mean, even though it's free, it's as high quality or better than many of the things you pay $40-$50 for in a game store. And so millions and millions of people worldwide have downloaded that game, and the Army now regards it as probably the most cost-effective outreach they've ever done.
The United Nations World Food Program, of all entities, have something called Food Force. What's the point there?
Well, the idea is you do things like try to accurately drop food out the back of a plane the way the UN does. You try to get agriculture in sort of a Sims-like way. Essentially, it's a game that's intended to teach kids who play it what it is the UN wrestles with as they try and stem world poverty.
A consciousness-raising exercise.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Now, there are different kinds of consciousness-raising. One is for the unalloyed good cause of feeding the world's hungry, and then there's slightly more controversial subjects like the notion of hating Japan in perpetuity for its crimes against China in the 30s and 40s, which apparently is the message of the Chinese Communist Youth League, which is trying to game its way into the hearts and minds of Chinese young people. Tell me about that one.
There's been a lot of examples of general shoot 'em ups with, you know, shooting aliens or whatever, but people take the game and put different looking enemies inside the game. It's called reskinning. For example, white supremacist groups have taken games and reskinned them to put in targets ranging from Jewish people to immigrants to anyone else that skinheads want to target. And so that's sort of the disturbing side of persuasive gaming, which is that games are a great way to reach young people, but also since they're a fairly easy thing to do, anyone, including some fairly noxious political elements, can create them.
I want to get back to the U.S. Army because it has created maybe the most successful of these persuasion games. But as we have read, the Army, because it's fighting a war in which people are getting killed left and right, is really having trouble recruiting young people. So is there necessarily a connection between the success of the game and the success of the underlying message?
That's a really good question. And a really interesting political example of that was a game that came out about a year and a half ago. It was a World War II game. It was produced here in the U.S. And in the game, you take the role of an American soldier who goes over to Japan to exact vengeance for Pearl Harbor. So you're running around and killing Japanese soldiers. This game came out in Japan and was incredibly popular. And when journalists asked the young Japanese players, you know, isn't there something a little alarming about you running around and killing Japanese men who, technically speaking, would be your fathers and grandfathers? They all responded the same way. They said, well, sort of, but I don't really think about it because it's just a really good game. And so there's something about when a game becomes really good and addictive that the actual content of the game almost sort of boils away and it becomes sort of just a form of sport.
Ah, so the solution is you want to brainwash the next generation, create a, you know, not very good game.
Exactly. Something right down the middle seems to be the best way to make a point.
Okay. Well, Clive, as always, thank you very much.
Take care.
Clive Thompson writes for Slate in the New York Times. His blog is collisiondetection.net.
Come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.